Next is State versus CP. If the parties could please come forward. Please have appearances of counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor. Chief Assistant Prosecutor, Jim Cherry, State County Prosecutor's Office.
Good morning, Your Honor. Colin Sheehan, Assistant Deputy Public Defender.
Alexander Shalom, Long Island Examiner, on behalf of the United States. Kevin Lee, Brian Walter Hayden, Negus on behalf of the University of the Criminal Defense Lawyers.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Kerrigan, please go ahead.
May it please the court, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Fine.
Thank you. Defendant CP applied for compassionate release under the Compassionate Release Act after murdering two people and attempting to murder a third person within a nearly four-year period under circumstances that two different law division judges found to be cruel, heinous, and depraved. Compassionate Release Act mandates that before deciding on a petition, a trial court judge must consider testimony or statements from a victim's family or survivors. In State versus AM, this court determined that trial court judges have discretion to grant or deny petitions for compassionate release if one or more extraordinary aggravating circumstances exist. Here, the trial court judge, Judge Marilyn Clark, analyzed the case over 4 days of a testimonial hearing, considered thousands of pages of evidence and found that three extraordinary aggravating factors existed. Judge Clark then exercised her discretion pursuant to State versus AM to deny the petition. The appellate division, applying the wrong standard of review in reviewing this case de novo, found that Judge Clark abused her discretion after the appellate division reviewed a cold record, looking at only at transcripts. The appellate division found that Judge Clark abused her discretion by finding that defendant CP was again convicted of two different counts of murder and one count of attempted murder, committed over a nearly four-year period of time. The appellate division found that Judge Clark abused her discretion by denying her petition for compassionate release. Your Honors, I've indicated that defendant CP was convicted of three different homicidal acts. However, Judge Clark's use of discretion could be affirmed even if we analyzed only the most recent in time of those three acts. Defendant CP was convicted of the 1996 murder of 18-year-old Tara Carter. Your Honors, that instance involved premeditation and planning. It involved a brutal murder, desecration of Ms. Carter's body, and concealment of the crime after the fact. In the murder of Ms. Carter, the defendant solicited her 18-year-old daughter, her teenage daughter, to impersonate Ms. Carter, take out a life insurance policy in her name. Defendant then solicited her teenage daughter's boyfriend to murder Ms. Carter. Defendant carried out the murder by preying on her relationship with Ms. Carter, which Ms. Carter's family described as a mother-daughter type relationship. Defendant asked Ms. Carter to turn her back so that she could do her hair, at which point defendant told her accomplice, now is your chance. Defendant's accomplice then bludgeoned Ms. Carter to death, striking her 4 to 5 times with a crowbar. After the crime, defendant and her accomplice put Ms. Carter's body in a sleeping bag without identification and dumped it in a park in Patterson, necessitating Ms. Carter's family members had to identify Ms. Carter's body from photographs shown by police. After the crime, defendant lied to police about her whereabouts, and her son also lied to police about her whereabouts. Both were convicted of hindering. Your Honor, the language of extraordinary aggravating factor one largely mirrors the language of aggravating factor one at sentencing under 2C44-1. That language has been interpreted by published case law to apply to cases where there were circumstances such as these involving premeditation and planning, involving a brutal method of murder, involving concealment, and involving desecration of the body. As such, Your Honors, even if we only look at defendant's first or most latest victim, one of the three victims, and even if we only look at the first of the three extraordinary aggravating factors, Judge Clark's use of discretion should be sustained. But of course, we're looking at the entire case, not just one victim and not just one factor. Judge Clark's finding that Ms. Carter was a particularly vulnerable victim should also be affirmed. Ms. Carter was 18 years old at the time of the murder, living on her own, away from her family and away from her two-year-old daughter for the first time in her life. Ms. Carter's family had grown up alongside defendant's family. Ms. Carter was defendant's daughter's best friend, and Ms. Carter looked up to defendant as a mother figure. Now, like extraordinary aggravating factor one, extraordinary aggravating factor two largely mirrors the language of aggravating factor two under the sentencing aggravating factors of 2C44-1. The language of 2C44-1A2 has been interpreted to encompass situations where a vulnerability is created by a defendant, which is exactly what happened here. Over the course of Ms. Carter's life, defendant cultivated a relationship and fostered a relationship with Ms. Carter that led Ms. Carter to rely on her, to look up to her as a mother figure, and to trust her. And that's why Ms. Carter turned her back, rendering herself vulnerable to attack that eventually ended her life by defendant's accomplice. The third extraordinary aggravating factor found by Judge Clark should also be affirmed. That being the fourth extraordinary aggravating factor identified by this court in State versus AM, involving the grief suffered by the victims and the ongoing pain that would be caused by a defendant's release. Unlike extraordinary aggravating factors one and two, extraordinary aggravating factor four does not have any parallel in the sentencing aggravating factors. And I would submit that it is a challenging extraordinary aggravating factor to apply, not just because of that, but because of the nature of grief and how difficult it is to quantify. I would argue that Judge Clark utilized what I would term the sharpest tool in her judicial toolbox to apply this aggravating factor to the best of her ability. What Judge Clark did was hear live testimony from the victim's family members, from surviving family members, over a four-day evidentiary hearing, and then evaluate that testimony, evaluating how the victim's family members testified, the nature of their testimony, their body language, the emotion in their voices, to seek to quantify, to seek to determine objectively that level of grief that they suffered and the level of grief that they would suffer if defendant was released.
How does the testimony in this case materially differ from the testimony in AM?
Yes, Your Honor. And I understand that in AM, this court reversed the appellate division decision and ordered AM's release. The victims in this case suffered differently than the victims in AM. Given the relationship between Ms. Carter and defendant and Ms. Carter's family and defendant. Your Honors, in addition to Judge Clark's assessment of the victim's testimony, objectively, grief can be exacerbated and prolonged in circumstances where a crime is committed and is a complete surprise to the victim's family. I understand most crimes are a surprise at some level. However, in this case, the crime was particularly gruesome and particularly upsetting to the victim's family members, given that the victim's family had placed such trust in the defendant. Given that the victim's family had grown up alongside, victim had grown up alongside the defendant, they were neighbors growing up. Excuse me. Pre-sentence report outlines the way that the families would go on vacation together. Excuse me, Judge, it was not the pre-sentence report, that was part of the testimony. Families would vacation together. The families were neighbors. They were close. Ms. Carter's family, upon moving to Georgia, placed their family member, their vulnerable family member, 18-year-old Ms. Carter, in the care of defendant. excuse me. Throughout the testimony, throughout the testimony, you see not only testimony that they suffered grief that would be expected when a family member is dead, is killed, but a type of more extreme grief that's experienced by family members who feel guilt and responsibility for their family member's death. They trusted CP, they trusted defendant. They believed that defendant had Ms. Carter's best interests at heart, and they believed that she would care for and take care of defendant, of Ms. Carter. That trust was betrayed. And I would submit that objectively, when trust is betrayed, grief is exacerbated and prolonged. That guilt is coupled with responsibility. I would submit that as the testimony progressed, the survivors testified about how, as the case progressed and they learned that Ms. Carter was not CP's first victim, that she had already murdered her husband, that she had already attempted to murder her autistic tenant, Mr. Eugene Cooper. This guilt that the family members felt was, again, exacerbated as they realized that they had entrusted 18-year-old Ms. Carter to the care of someone who was a killer. As they learned more about the case, as they learned how wrong they had been to entrust Ms. Carter to their care.
When you say entrusted Ms. Carter to CP's care, what was the testimony about that?
I'm sorry, what was the last part of Your Honor's question?
What was the testimony about that? Explain more about what that means. Was there some sort of specific conversation? Had Ms. Carter been younger than 18 when her family moved and there was some sort of explicit or discussed agreement that CP would look after Ms. Carter?
So I don't think that there was a necessarily a discussed agreement, but what I did see from the pre-sentence report and from the testimony, Your Honor, was that Ms. Carter was 18 years old. Her family moved from Paterson, New Jersey, to Georgia. Ms. Carter initially moved with them to Georgia, but returned to Paterson to be near her friends and to start her life there. Ms. Carter's two-year-old daughter remained in Georgia at the time. So through the testimony, and I would also submit through the letters that were submitted by multiple members of defendants of Ms. Carter's family, the family members express not necessarily that there was a conversation or a contract or an agreement with CP that they would take care of her, but that given their relationship with defendant, given the fact that they had grown up together, given the fact that they had vacationed together, the victim's family members understood that they were not just leaving Ms. Carter alone in the city of Paterson to fend for herself. They were leaving her with someone who knew her, someone who had watched her grow up, and someone who cared for her, someone who would step in if there was a problem. And what I would submit is that that trust was betrayed in the most extreme way possible. Not only did defendant not look after Ms. Carter, not care for Ms. Carter, not only was she not there for her, she solicited her daughter to take out a fraudulent insurance policy on Ms. Carter's life and then arranged for her murder. That would be the most extreme betrayal of trust I think I could imagine.
The daughter was the former best friend of the victim.
Yes, Your Honor. So it was not even just a situation where this was someone from the community who they trusted. It was someone from the community who, again, Ms. Carter had grown up alongside with her as a member of the community, but also had sleepovers at her house. She had hosted sleepovers. Defendant's daughter was, as Your Honor indicated, Ms. Carter's best friend, which also highlights the power that defendant wielded over other people, using the power of her mind to convince people to do these things for her. Facts showed that the defendant solicited her teenage daughter's boyfriend to stab Mr. Cooper with the intention of killing him and collecting his life insurance policy. The defendant convinced her son to lie for her after Ms. Carter's death, resulting in her son's conviction for hindering. And as Your Honor mentioned, the most extreme instance is defendant's ability to convince her teenage daughter to betray her best friend and participate in her best friend's murder by impersonating her best friend and obtaining a fraudulent life insurance policy that her mother, defendant CP, then sought to collect on after arranging for her death.
Counsel, well, it's clear that all of these emotions that the victim's family members have suffered makes sense given all the details that you've given us, but how does this equate, or was there testimony about their well-being currently and how that would be affected by CP's release or the recovery process that they might still be ongoing? How have those issues been touched upon or affected by the possibility of CP's release?
I suppose if Your Honor's question is whether there was some sort of psychological or expert testimony about the nature of grief and how it might be prolonged or how it was prolonged in this circumstance.
No, even from those individuals personally and their objective discussion of what impact it would have on them now. Most of what you've discussed and what you've described to us in the testimony seems to have stemmed directly from the things they suffered as a result of the incident, of the incidents that occurred in this case, the crimes. But what about what impact the release will have on their continuous well-being or their recovery, as I'm sure goes on for the rest of their lives? So what impact has it had on that? Was there testimony about those pieces?
I understand Your Honor's question. There was testimony from three different representatives of Ms. Carter's family, her daughter, Benicia Curry, her sister, Ms. Rosie Carter, and one of her best friends. And the court highlighted, and I would highlight for Your Honor, the testimony of Ms. Rosie Carter, who specified that, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but it was along the lines of, I've been here for every hearing in this case. I've followed this case from the very beginning, and I will continue to follow this case throughout. And I believe the court also highlighted that both Ms. Rosie Carter and Ms. Curry, defendant's daughter, described how they and their family were affected by this, described how they believed that having to come back to court and testify about this matter again, which they had thought was closed, was hurtful to them, was harmful to them. And they described how defendant's actions had impacted them moving forward. I would also highlight Ms. Benicia Curry's testimony, and Ms. Benicia Curry, Ms. Carter's daughter, was 2 years old at the time of the crime, but she offered testimony to the trial court about how learning of the nature of her mother's death and growing up without a mother left her with issues related to trust. And both she and Ms. Rosie Carter testified about how since learning that defendant had betrayed Ms. Carter's trust so severely and so significantly, they had trouble trusting people going forward. Ms. Benicia Curry testified specifically about how she had been in counseling to try to learn how to trust people, which she had trouble doing because she knew that her mother had been killed by someone who she had placed a great amount of trust in, who she regarded as a mother figure. So Judge, and what I was saying when I initially sought to answer your question was there was no expert testimony about the nature of grief, how it's prolonged, when it's prolonged. But these lay witnesses testified to circumstances and feelings that they had that I would submit permitted Judge Clark to exercise her discretion to find extraordinary aggravating factor for.
Counsel, you indicated that Eugene Cooper was autistic. Is there evidence in the record that Carter also was autistic? And I'm particularly focusing on testimony by her sister, Rosie.
Your Honor, Ms. Rosie Carter's testimony was that Mr. Cooper was an autistic man. Judge Clark found based on that testimony, of course, that Mr. Cooper did suffer from autism. And I regret that I do not recall a portion of the record that indicated that Ms. Carter had autism. If Your Honor would like to direct me to a certain location, I can take a look.
I'm interested in learning whether you know of any evidence in the record that supports a finding that Carter also was autistic.
I am not familiar with any such evidence, no, Your Honor.
All right.
You've raised an alternative argument that
CP poses a threat to public safety?
Yes, Your Honor.
The trial court found otherwise.
Yes.
Do you challenge that on appeal?
No, Your Honor. The state was...
Is it properly here then, if the argument wasn't advanced before the appellate division?
I understand your question, Your Honor. I believe that it is properly here, yes. I believe it's properly here for two different reasons. First, procedurally, given that the trial court granted the petition, that point was not raised on appeal. The state was the respondent on appeal. The state responded to the points raised by the defendant. That point was not raised by defendant. My second point, Judge, I believe that procedurally it's properly here, but I also believe that substantively, the issue of whether a person convicted of two murders and one attempted murder, the issue of whether that person is a public safety threat if released, is an issue that is too important.
I think you'd said that the trial court granted the petition. I may have misheard you, but I think the trial court denied the petition.
Yes, I'm sorry. If I said that the trial court granted the petition, I misspoke. The trial court denied the petition. On appeal, CP challenged the trial court's findings of extraordinary aggravating factors. The state was the respondent on appeal, responded to those challenges.
But in responding, you could have raised the same alternative argument that you're raising here, but you did not, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
You didn't attempt to cross-petition, you know, that portion of the trial court's judgment, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, yes.
Stay with the argument for just a moment.
Yes, Your Honor.
Nonetheless, if an individual commits an offense through their power of persuasion, doesn't engage in any physical conduct, can a person who is mentally fit ever qualify for compassionate release? What's your position?
Specific to this case, I would say this defendant does not qualify. To answer Your Honor's question directly, yes, a person who solicits murder could qualify for compassionate release, even if that person didn't suffer from any disease of the mind.
How would they be able to show that they're no longer a danger?
Well, that would be specific to the case, Your Honor. I think what I pointed out in my written submission was that in State versus FED, this court pointed out that the to release someone pursuant to the CRA, the evidence would have to show not only that the permanent physical incapacity renders that person incapable of committing another murder, but also renders that person incapable of soliciting another person.
Can you give us an example of how they would demonstrate in a case like this that they were no longer a threat to public safety?
I'm sorry. So let me make sure I understand Your Honor's question. How someone who
Who is mentally fit today,
yes,
who committed an offense similar to the one that we're talking about, how would they demonstrate they were no longer a threat?
I understand Your Honor's question. There would be circumstances distinct from this case, I think, that would have to exist for a person convicted of soliciting a murder to show by clear and convincing evidence that they're not a threat to, again, solicit murder.
You're referring to the underlying offense. You're hearkening back to how the offense was committed or the details of the offense rather than anything that could be said between then and the request for release.
Yes. And the reason I'm going back to the offense is because in State versus FED, this court specifically pointed out that a person convicted of murder would have to show, again, that they're physically incapable of soliciting another person to commit such a crime. So I think that in order for a person who didn't suffer from any disease of the mind and who was convicted of soliciting murder to make that showing or to benefit from that showing, there'd have to be circumstances distinct from this case. Again, if someone were convicted of soliciting perhaps only one murder, that might be a distinct circumstance. As I pointed out, this defendant was convicted of murder twice, attempted murder once. Two of those instances involve solicitation. One of those instances involved essentially multiple solicitation, Ms. Carter's act. Not only didn't defendant solicit the actual person who actually wielded the weapon and committed the physical act of murder, defendant solicited her son to lie for her after the crime. Defendant solicited her daughter to set up the crime by obtaining the fraudulent insurance policy. Defendant solicited these people, abusing positions of trust, abusing relationships that she had fostered with these people, abusing an imbalance of power she had over her, again, at this point, teenage children who she involved in her crimes.
But defendant argues that in the years that she was incarcerated after the crime, she was primarily incarcerated on the minimum compound at the prison, which houses less serious offenders, and therefore reflects that DOC, at least, did not see her as a threat to prison safety. How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't believe there's any testimony from the DOC about why they categorized her in that way, if they categorized her in that way, whether they initially categorized her in that way. That being said, a person's conduct while in prison is distinctly different than a person's conduct while they are free in on the streets. What the appellate division decision in this case does, if allowed to stand, would be to release this woman back onto the streets where she would be free. With minimal restraints by parole. The last time defendant CP was free on the streets, she was arrested within, I think, weeks of the brutal murder of Ms. Carter, which occurred just a few months after the stabbing of Mr. Cooper that she solicited, which occurred just a few years after CP's act of poisoning her husband, killing him and collecting his $39,000 life insurance policy. So the last time that defendant was free was not in prison. She engaged in a almost 4-year course of conduct that involved two different murders and one attempted murder.
Is it fair to say that if she had been placed in a maximum security location and that there had been incidents while in custody that she had solicited other inmates to perform crimes while in prison that you were aware of, that you would likely rely on that to support your argument that she would reoffend? Is that fair to say?
Yes, I think that would be relevant.
So wouldn't it also be fair to use the lack of any of that evidence over the past decades as at least relevant to try to inform the question of whether or not there would be any risk of reoffense?
Yes, and that evidence was put before Judge Clark. It was put before the trial court, and it was considered by Judge Clark alongside the other evidence, including the evidence related to the commission of the crimes, the testimony of the victims, the evidence related to the relationships between the victims and the defendant. Judge Clark used her discretion after observing live witness testimony and found that despite that evidence, which may be favorable to defendant, that evidence was outweighed by the other evidence, namely things like the fact that there's multiple victims, the fact that these are repeat offenses committed over and over, over an almost 4-year period of time, the fact that there's a financial motive, premeditation, planning, vulnerable victims, brutality, concealment and hindering, desecration of the body. So I'd submit that it is not an abuse of discretion for Judge Clark to consider that those factors outweighed the violence-free period of her imprisonment.
Anything else you'd like to add, counsel?
Judge, if your honors have no more questions, I have a brief summary I'd like to present before my
questions. Anyone? Go ahead, please.
Your honor, what I'd like to point out in conclusion, and I'll be brief, is that I pointed out some of the factors that influence this case, some of the factual arguments. Again, repeat offenses, multiple victims, financial motive, premeditation and planning, vulnerable victims, brutality, concealment, hindering, desecration of remains. The appellate division explicitly found in their opinion that those factors were common to the crime of murder, that they do not rise to the level of extraordinary. And I don't mean to say that they explicitly found those factors. They found that this case, which involves those factors, involves circumstances common to the crime of murder, involves circumstances that do not rise to the level of extraordinary. And as I presented through my submissions and through my argument today, This case does present factors that are extraordinary. It does present factors that are not common to the crime of murder. It is not common to the crime of murder for a person to victimize three different people over a nearly four-year period of time, all with a financial motive, all pre-planned, all planned months in advance so that she could secure fraudulent insurance policies. Defendant could have stopped at any time. She could have stopped after she killed her husband. But a few years later, she decided to take out a fraudulent insurance policy on her autistic tenant, Mr. Cooper, and then solicit his murder. She could have stopped after that. But rather than that, she decided to solicit her teenage daughter to take out a fraudulent policy on her best friend and then arrange for her murder. These are not circumstances common to the crime of murder. These are extraordinary circumstances, which more than adequately provide evidence upon which this court could affirm Judge Clark's proper use of discretion in denying the petition. The appellate division is wrong when they say that these facts are common to the crime of murder. And I would respectfully request that this court overturn the flawed and incorrect appellate division decision and reinstate Judge Clark's ruling denying the petition.
Thank you, Mr. Kerrigan.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Galimba.
May it please the court, the Attorney General agrees with the state that the multiple extraordinary aggravating factors that existed here justify the trial court's discretionary decision to deny compassionate release and wishes to emphasize the following 4 points. First, the commission of two murders and an attempted murder over a four-year course of conduct involving murder for hire, murder for profit, and utterly calculated planning is extraordinary. Second, it matters that CP targeted vulnerable individuals for all three of her homicidal acts. Third, if the CRA's emphasis on victim impact is to have meaning, then a judge's finding of multiple specific factors specific to the case supporting the particularly detrimental impact on victims should be respected, particularly when that's based on live testimony. And fourth, the safety prong was not met in this case because CP's crimes are precisely of the nature that she could continue to commit in spite of her physical limitations. And I wanted to start off with an overarching point about the extraordinary aggravating factors that this court selected. The appellate division and CP are reading AM to essentially require another level of extraordinarily extraordinary factors. But this court selected the factors it did out of the universe of aggravating factors, and there's 15 aggravating factors for sentencing. They were selected because they are extraordinary. So extraordinary is already baked into the calculus when you're considering particularly heinous, cruel, or depraved conduct, or particularly vulnerable victims. These words already express that we're talking about extraordinary circumstances. So the existence of these factors at sentencing should suffice to establish in a CRA petition the existence of extraordinary aggravating factors.
Sorry, so does that mean you're arguing that a finding of aggravating factor one at sentencing automatically leads to a finding of extraordinary aggravating factor one in a petition for compassionate release?
It should in almost all cases, because the language of aggravating factor one, talking about extremely heinous, cruel, or depraved conduct versus the language this court used in AM, particularly heinous, cruel, or depraved conduct. I don't know what conduct would specifically qualify for sentencing factor one, but not in the context of a compassionate release petition. When we're talking about heinous, cruel, or depraved, we're talking about conduct that goes to the extremes of what the particular crime is. So in most situations, I would think finding of one would necessarily satisfy a finding in this context as well.
But in AM, the court specifically held that lower courts can't create, and this court is not creating, any, quote, de facto categorical barriers to compassionate release. So wouldn't a finding of aggravating factor one be a de facto categorical barrier?
I don't think so, Your Honor. That said in AM, this court was talking about particular crimes can't be a basis to deny a petition. A murder, just because somebody commits a murder, that can't be a basis to deny a petition. That's
specifically because the legislature amended the statute to provide that, right? So the prior version of the statute did provide that certain categories of crimes would leave someone ineligible. But this version of the statute specifically does not and includes even someone who's convicted of murder. So the court would not have been free to ignore that. That was a vital part of the statute as enacted by the legislature, correct?
Of course. But I think there's this distinction between the type of crime, murder, versus the actual facts of the crime. And when we're talking about heinous, cruel, or depraved conduct, we're talking about the facts of the crime. So if their facts exist to find aggravating factor one at sentencing, there's necessarily something about the crime that makes it not just a quote unquote ordinary murder.
But I'm not suggesting it happened here because we have Judge Clark's findings, but a court couldn't on a petition for compassionate release couldn't simply say, well, Judge so-and-so back at sentencing 25 years ago found aggravating factor one, done, fine, moving on to the next one.
No, and I don't mean to suggest that. Ultimately, the reviewing court is going to be reviewing the decision made by the compassionate release judge. So I think maybe as a best practice, if the second judge, the motion judge, differs from the first judge on a finding, that should probably be stated clearly so to aid in appellate review. But there could potentially be a disagreement.
But the statute and AM really envision, do they not, an independent view of the facts of the particular crime by the judge at the compassionate release motion? Am I right?
Absolutely. And the compassionate release judge has to review the entire record, make new findings, cannot just simply rubber stamp what was found at sentencing.
Did the court in AM say that if you find an aggravating factor in the code, that's enough to satisfy one of the four extraordinary factors it identified?
No, but the court in AM borrowed the language from the sentencing context and referred to the analogous criteria in the sentencing context.
So it said it turned there for guidance. And then in the summary paragraph that follows the language you just alluded to, the court said the standard is a necessarily high one, whether extraordinary aggravating factors exist. Such factors can't be used as a substitute for all serious crimes. They're limited to exceptional and rare circumstances to comport with the statute's goal of increasing the use of compassionate release. It's not taking what's baked in to aggravating factors and using that as the test, or is it, as you understand it?
As I understand the language, it's using, again, there's 15 aggravating factors.
Are they the same? Is my question. As you understand it, is it simply, well, you've got the aggravating factor over there, that's enough to qualify for any of the four aggravating factors, extraordinary aggravating factors that the court identified in AM?
Yes, that would be my argument.
You got that from the language I quoted as well?
Yes, because
you're saying what made the factors extraordinary was just that the court chose four out of 15?
The court, two of these factors come specifically out of the sentencing aggravating factors, the 15.
It doesn't the adjective extraordinary before the terms aggravating factors suggest that there is a higher standard being imposed here than there is at sentencing?
Well, the court said that a petition should be generally granted if the petitioner meets the first two prongs, the medical and safety, unless extraordinary circumstances exist, then lists these four factors, one of which is particularly heinous, cruel, or depraved conduct. That, to me, suggests that that is a extraordinary circumstance, the particularly cruel, heinous, depraved conduct, which is almost precisely the way that aggravating factor one in the sentencing context.
So to be clear, under your proposal, you just stop after you've said, well, we met the code's aggravating factor. That's enough.
Yes, but let me.
I don't think the opinion says that.
Okay. Well, then let me move into my secondary argument. And even if a heightened showing were required, that clearly exists here. Three acts of murder and an attempted murder committed over a 4-year course of conduct. That is extraordinary. For one of the victims,
would multiple murders always satisfy factor one?
I think in almost all cases, particularly where the murders are committed at separate times, that would be extremely heinous, cruel, or depraved conduct.
Did Judge Clark's findings suggest in any way that she saw this standard to be the same as the standard under aggravating factor one at sentencing? I don't see that. That's the reason I'm saying that. I see her findings as concluding that a very high standard exists and a very high standard was reached in this case.
I agree with Your Honor, and I think that is how the judge was interpreting it, was that extraordinary facts needed to exist, and this was extraordinary conduct. To get back to the Chief Justice's question, this court doesn't need to decide whether two murders always qualifies as particularly heinous, cruel, or depraved, because there's so many aspects of this case that rise to that level, including the fact that this was such calculated planning, that it was committed over such a long period, that these were completely separate events. The fact that she solicited others to carry out the crimes, the fact that she targeted people close to her, people with vulnerabilities, who she basically saw as dollar signs. That's what these crimes amounted to.
Counsel, should the court reviewing this particular aggravating factor separate those terms, or just use them as a catch-all? Because they are very different in terms of how they're defined. Heinous, depraved, or cruel. Is there any distinction that the court should draw, or is it simply under these circumstances, as counsel for the state said, the manner of the victim's death, the motivation, the financial gain, the planning required, do they just all equal heinous, depraved, and cruel in all circumstances?
I think that the court doesn't need to define what qualifies as heinous, cruel, or depraved. It's more that these circumstances in their totality reach that level. Heinous, cruel, and depraved, when it's been used in the sentencing context, has generally referred to something that goes beyond to the extreme reaches of the crime. It could be extraordinary brutality. It could be extreme premeditation. So I don't think we can necessarily label it by the dictionary definition, which is generally something defined as evil, or is completely lacking in the person's completely lacking those basic human emotions. Although I think that this would meet that dictionary definition, but I don't think the court needs to do that. I think it's more just the existence of these facts arise to that under the totality, if that answers the court's question. But repeatedly killing, it shows such a lack of remorse, such a lack of scruples, a lack of guilt. CP didn't commit a mere offense. This was three different offenses, all of which involved multiple offenses. So the Compassionate Release Act, it doesn't entirely supplant the residual aims of criminal punishment. And this court recognized in AM, referring to the criteria, the sentencing criteria. And when you consider aggravating factors one in the sentencing criteria, multiple victims can play into that too, particularly when you're considering somebody like CP, who received concurrent life sentences for murder and a consecutive sentence for attempted murder. So this is a targeting multiple victims is extraordinary. It is particularly heinous, cruel, or depraved. If that were the only fact, that could probably arise to that definition. But again, it was not just the fact that she killed two and almost killed a third. It was the way in which she did it. It was the fact that it involved murder for hire, murder for profit, the extraordinary planning, the fact that she targeted, she used people close to her. She manipulated both family members and non-family members alike and targeted family members and people who are close to her as well. So the first factor was clearly satisfied. The second factor, in terms of the vulnerability of the particular victims, there was a question, I believe, from Justice Fascialli about Ms. Carter, whether there was any evidence of her vulnerability. There was nothing in terms of her also having autism. The vulnerability there was that she was an 18-year-old living away from home. She was depending on CP for lodging. She had this close relationship with CP's family, was best friends with CP's daughter. So she had this, what I'll call intrinsic condition of youth. She's being an 18-year-old, and then CP exploits that.
To what extent do you rely on her youth in this argument?
Well, I think it is an important part of, because again, looking at the language of AM, this court selected age, disability, or youth. So there has to be some one of those intrinsic conditions. But then it's not just the fact that she has that intrinsic condition, youth. It's also the fact that CP then takes advantage of that condition.
I ask because the Attorney General has steadfastly drawn the line at the age of majority, particularly with respect to sentencing arguments that have come before the court for those between the ages of 18 and 26, and has maintained these are adults. And now you're arguing she was only 18, she was youthful, and that that factors in. How do you reconcile those positions?
Well, I think it's a little different when you're talking about the victim. There is still a question of maturity in terms of, it's not just a matter of her age in and of itself. The fact that she could vote, that doesn't mean that she was necessarily mature and capable of making decisions that that somebody with more life experience was capable of making. She, even knowing, for example, even knowing that CP had killed her husband, Ms. Carter remained in that house, and it also ultimately cost her life. So I think it does go to her judgment.
The testimony was that Ms. Carter knew that CP had killed her husband and still chose to live there?
Not that she chose. Well, she was going to get out, but she did not immediately get out. Her sister and her had discussed moving back with their family in Georgia. So they were days away from leaving. But what I meant to say is that even knowing that basically this woman who she looked up to as a mother figure, even knowing that she was a killer, she did not immediately get out of the house. So that suggests some lack of judgment on her part.
What was the testimony that she learned that CP was a killer when?
It was days before she ultimately was killed. That's according to her sister's testimony.
And she planned to leave soon.
Right. She planned to leave the day after she was killed. Correct. But it's not just Ms. Carter's vulnerability of being a youth. There also is the fact that Mr. Cooper did have autism. That was according to, again, Ms. Carter's sister. And it's also apparent from the pre-sentence report that he had a supervisor or a manager looking over his finances and looking over many other aspects of his life. And then her husband was ill. She was in the general course was providing him medicine in his food and drink, and she would tell her children not to have any of his food or drink because she would put medicine in it, which in fact she was poisoning him with her own medicine. So that's three vulnerable victims. Only if one of these victims were vulnerable, that would be enough to deny the petition. But again, this factor, this price satisfied.
Counsel, similar to how the first aggravating factor is, you suggested it was sort of the extreme of particular offenses. Isn't the second factor particularly vulnerable individuals? So it's sort of the other way, where we're looking for those extreme circumstances of people that are particularly vulnerable, because the most victims are sort of taken in a moment of weakness when they can be taken advantage of in most criminal circumstances. So doesn't this factor require a little bit more than simply general vulnerability, like an 18-year-old, perhaps somebody even younger, or perhaps somebody whose developmental delays may actually put them in a vulnerable situation at all times? Doesn't it require something more?
Well, I think that certainly existed with Mr. Cooper. He signed away, I think it shows some of his lack of judgment, he signed away his life insurance benefits to a woman who was basically housing him. So I think there is evidence in here to suggest that she was taking advantage of these particular vulnerabilities. It wasn't just the fact that they had what I'll call vulnerabilities, and I'm not to say that autism is all the time indicative of a vulnerability, but there is enough in the record here to support that Mr. Cooper wasn't capable of making some decisions that were in his best interest, and that CP then capitalized on. So I think it's a combination of two things. I think it's the combination of the fact that they had these vulnerabilities, and then CP utilized or exploited those vulnerabilities. And to get to your point about, you know, whether it has to go, well, there has to be extraordinary. I think the fact that it was three different victims goes to that level of extraordinariness. If it had just been one victim, that might be enough. But it was, this court doesn't need to decide that because there were three victims in that position. With respect,
would you have a weaker argument in a case where Ms. Carter was killed perhaps by someone else who's also 18 in a fight or something along those lines, or for whatever reason, and there wasn't this feature of a quasi-parental relationship developed over years that put her into this vulnerable position where she was ordered to be killed?
Yes, I would agree with that, Your Honor. If it was two college students, for example, and one killed the other, I don't think that this factor would necessarily exist. I think the fact that CP, she was in her 40s at the time that this murder happened, providing for an 18-year-old, I think that does bear on this factor significantly. Briefly, as to the fourth aggravating factor, the victim impact, I just want to emphasize that the Judge Clark was in a superior position to make that determination. She had the benefit of watching and listening to these victims testify. The reviewing court only has a cold record. Just because a reviewing court might disagree, that doesn't show an abuse of discretion. And at bottom, the judge's findings were amply supported by the record. Of course, with most murders, there's going to be survivors that are impacted and significantly impacted, but not all are the same. And grief is very case specific. Some survivors may have been able to move on or even forgiven their loved one's killer, but others may justifiably feel that the crimes are unforgivable. And how the victim died can be a relevant factor. Miss Carter's family has to live with the image of their loved one being bludgeoned as she was sitting at the table, curling her hair, and then having her body disposed in a park. So all of this can bear on whether there's an objectively reasonable basis in the record to show that there is a particularly detrimental impact. Another point.
Do you believe that the trial court could have denied compassionate release based only on a finding of extraordinary aggravating factor one, and so technically didn't have to reach factors two or four?
Yes. And the court said that in AM, that the existence of one or more of these factors is a basis to, is enough to deny relief. And then I just wanted to touch briefly on the safety aspect. And I believe the court should address this issue, even though it was not raised in the appellate division. I think this is a little different of a procedural context because the state did make the argument in the first instance in the trial court. The trial court did rule on it. And then the state was in the position of respondent in the appellate division. They could have raised it in the appellate division, but typically when you're a respondent, you're responding to the arguments raised by the defense. But once they found themselves in the Supreme Court, of course, they were in a different position. They argued it in the motion for a stay. It was raised in the petition for certification, which—
Why does that preserve the issue if it was dropped at the appellate division level for whatever reason?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that, Your Honor?
Why does that preserve the issue before this court?
Under the court rule, I believe it's 212.11, typically arguments, if they're raised in the petition for certification, and if the petition is generally granted, that will preserve.
I'm talking about what happened at the appellate division, that the matter wasn't pursued at that level. Why does that then come back to life in front of this court?
I think the difference is that it was raised at the inception. It was raised in the trial court level.
But isn't all the case law that says if an argument's not made on appeal, it's waived? That's where it was raised in the trial court, and then it's dropped on appeal, and then the case law is still okay. Then it's waived because you dropped it on appeal,
and you lost the argument at the trial court level.
Yes, but that's generally a finding that's made at the appellate division level. When you're at the level of the Supreme Court, if the argument is raised in the petition, if the petition is granted, then it generally is before the court. The appeal is before the court. And this was raised in the petition for certification. I would say that waiver—
But the court can grant a petition that raises an issue but still find waiver, and that's happened many times.
Yes.
In other words, It would be a pretty low bar if all you had to do with a previously waived issue was raise it in the petition.
Yes,
this wouldn't mean very much.
Yes, this court can find waiver based on that. I would say that waiver is not a mandatory finding if there's an issue of particular public importance. And
Counsel, why don't you give us 2 minutes on this issue, and then we'll be on
the
merits.
Sure. So there's really two parts to this danger analysis. One is whether that the inmate demonstrates by clear and convincing evidence that they are permanently physically incapable of committing a crime if released. And second, whether the conditions under which the inmate would be released would pose a threat to public safety. And it's the Attorney General's position that there was not a record basis to satisfy either factor. The first factor is just a straightforward, commonsensical consideration of whether the physical condition precludes commission of the same or similar type of conduct. Because CP's crimes were committed by soliciting others to do her bidding, she is precisely the archetype of who the legislature had in mind in setting forth this condition.
Trial court acknowledged that and specifically found that CP does not pose a threat to society if released because, quote, she would be in no position to carry out or mastermind new offenses, even though, quote, her prior offenses were not committed by her own physical strength. So the trial court acknowledged that and still found that she's not physically that she is physically incapable, alone or with the assistance of another, of committing the same crime. Isn't that reviewed only for abuse of discretion?
The problem, yes, it is reviewed for an abuse of discretion. The problem is what Your Honor just read was the entirety of the judge's finding on that factor, that she would not be in a position. But it's not explained how she would not be in a position. I think what Judge Clark was getting to more was that second part of whether the conditions under which the inmate would be released would pose a threat to safety, not the first part of whether the physical condition precludes commission of the same or similar crimes. That's just whether.
But she specifically said at page 56 of the opinion, not physically capable alone or with the assistance of another of committing the same crime, correct?
Yes. She said that, but she didn't. She overlooked a number of facts. The fact that CP does still retain limited, certainly at the time of the hearing, retained limited mobility. She also was able to communicate her wishes. She testified coherently at the hearing, and she's still mentally fit. So all of these were facts that should have been considered, considering that none of her crimes relied on pure physical strength.
So what would a mentally fit person have to demonstrate in order to be found that they were not capable? They were no longer a threat to society.
Well, I think it is difficult if your crimes were soliciting murder to make that showing. It's going to be a more difficult showing because this factor looks at what the underlying crimes were. So CP's underlying crimes were soliciting others.
Suggesting that someone who has been convicted of soliciting cannot overcome that?
I'm not suggesting it can never be shown. I'm suggesting it's going to be more difficult. As long as CP's able to carry on private conversations, she's capable.
But this case, and you've very carefully outlined the specific facts of this case. This case is not a case where somebody simply makes a phone call or types of an email or sends a text saying, by the way, please kill this person on X date. Especially when you look at the Carter murder. She's on the scene, she's physically and mentally controlling the people around her to get this done, and seeing the opportunity and acting and directing that the killing take place in a way that is more than simply the ability to communicate. It is she's physically present and running what's going on in that room. Would you agree with me with that?
I would agree with that, Your Honor, but I wouldn't necessarily agree that she's not capable of carrying out such crimes by not being physically present.
But what I'm saying is if you look at her physical condition today and think about that crime, if we're talking about the facts of that particular crime, is she really in a position to do that again if she wanted to do that again?
Not that specifically. No, she could not be. She would be. I don't want to even go that far necessarily, because she did. She was able to move around at least a limited amount in a wheelchair. She was able to walk for a distance, assisted with.
Now you're saying was, and you referenced earlier that there was other motion practice in this case about her current physical state. And do we know what her current physical state is, and what are we looking only at as of the time of the hearing, which now was several years ago, or are we looking now?
I think what this court is doing is reviewing the decision of the trial court. So I think we have to look at the trial court's reasons and not necessarily what's happened since. Of course, CP did file a motion subsequently to lift the stay that this court had imposed. I think we can only, this court is just looking at whether the trial judge abused her discretion or not. So we have to look at the trial judge's reasons and the evidence that was in front of the trial judge.
Counsel, we're a little bit beyond a half hour at this point. As amicus, I'd like you to try to draw your argument to a close. Anything else you'd like to present to us?
I don't have anything else. The Attorney General would just ask that the decision of the appellate division be reversed and the trial court's order be reinstated.
Thank you.